Chapter 4. Quote, "First, believe that a god is a being in a state of bliss and immortality. If you accept this, you cannot attribute to the gods anything that is contrary to immortality or that is inconsistent with a state of bliss. Rather, you will expect of them whatever sustains both their state of bliss and their immortality. For truly there are gods, and belief in them is obvious. But they are not such as the crowd think." End quote. Epicurus, 342-270 BCE. Really, Blair wished that throwing a temper tantrum had been one of his options. He thought kicking and yelling and pounding his fists on the floor to protest the generally fucked-up state of the universe would have made him feel better, at least for a minute or two. It wouldn't have done anything for Jim, though, who was parked in front of the television set, pretending to watch sports coverage on the local late-night news. The beer in his hand was surely room temperature and flat by now. And even though the sportscaster was recapping tonight's game at length, Blair doubted Jim had any idea who'd won. He sat down next to him. "Looks like this is going to be Cascade's year after all, huh?" Jim nodded. "Looks like it." Blair sighed. "No, it doesn't. The Angels creamed us. Good thing we didn't buy season tickets." "Ah, good thing." "Hey, man." Blair reached for the remote and switched off the television. "You want to talk about it?" "Nothing to talk about," Jim said shortly. But he set down his beer and put his arm around Blair's shoulders. Blair leaned against him and patted his knee, and eventually Jim said, "Your Air Force buddies will be here any time now, and then our lives won't be our own again until they decide to leave. I can't see there's anything to gain by talking about it." Blair didn't bother to point out that they certainly weren't his buddies. "Are you sorry we reported this?" Jim huffed impatiently. "We didn't have a choice. It's so much bigger than anything. It's like... I know this sounds stupid, but it's like something just ripped through existence and then tried to sew everything up behind itself and didn't do a very fucking good job." Jim waved his free hand impatiently. "Ah, never mind. I can't make you understand." "No, I get it. It's too big and too freaky to ignore. And we can't possibly handle it on our own." "Yeah," Jim said. "That's it. But see, the thing that makes me nuts is that I don't think the Air Force has any idea what to do about it either. You remember what happened the last time the Revenuers showed? They walked through walls, zapped everyone with their ray guns, and then proceeded to do whatever the hell they wanted. You really think anything has changed in the last 4 months?" "I don't know. I have to hope so. Just not sure I can share your optimism, man." Jim cocked his head to the side. "I don't blame you. Blair, I'm going to ask you to do something for me, and you're not going to like it. Hear me out anyway." Damn. That meant he was really, really going to hate whatever Jim was about to say. Blair tried to control his breathing and not tense up. But he didn't imagine he fooled Jim for a minute. "I wouldn't ask if it weren't important," Jim said gently, And Blair nodded a little too fast. I know, man, and I'm listening. I am. Is Naomi still in Vermont?
She'll be at Middlebury through the start of the summer quarter.
Why don't you go visit her for a few weeks? It's been too long since you two have spent any time together.
What, now?
I know the plane ticket will be pretty steep, buying it at the last minute and all. Don't worry about it. I'll be glad to spot you for it.
You're asking me to leave?
Blair pulled away from him, stunned and a little hurt.
How could you think for 1 minute I could leave you alone with this?
Sandberg, you said you'd listen.
That was before I knew you were going to be talking like some kind of a crazy person.
No, Jim, just no. End of discussion.
I know you understand all about hierarchical command structures from a theoretical point of view, but I've lived in them for most of my adult life, and that means I know what's about to happen here. I know because it's exactly what I would do if I were in Colonel O'Neill's position.
Blair faltered a little.
Where are you going with this?
O'Neill's team is going to be trying to defend themselves, this town. Hell, maybe the whole planet, as far as I can tell.
You and me, Blair, we're just pawns. It doesn't matter that O'Neill's people don't mean us any harm. If we can help them gain their objectives, they'll use us just as ruthlessly as I used Nkotch's people to defend the Chopec Pass.
Aw, Jim, it's not...
If things get bad, I won't be able to protect you. I won't have any authority once this turns into a military operation.
It was too much. Blair put his hands on Jim's shoulders.
Slow down, he demanded. First of all, if things are going to get as bad as you think, then you definitely need me here with you. And just try to send me away, man. Just try.
But what makes you think this is going to turn into a war zone anyway?
They're only sending 3 people, after all.
Major Davis is the liaison for the Joint Chiefs, Jim said. So apparently the Pentagon is taking this pretty damned seriously.
Oh.
Blair let his hands fall and sat back on the sofa.
The Joint Chiefs. He felt dizzy.
Did you know that when he was here before?
He was on the phone practically the whole time. I couldn't help but know.
Blair managed a feeble smile.
Okay, you win. Now I'm freaking out. You mean to tell me that Naomi Sandberg's blue-eyed boy shared a mushroom and black olive pizza on Christmas Day with a man who works for the Joint Chiefs of Staff? I'll never live this down.
Does that mean you're going to get on a plane to Vermont after all?
Jim was smiling, but his eyes were sad.
Not a chance in hell. He smoothed his hand over Jim's forehead and was leaning in to kiss him when Jim pulled him in for a quick hug instead and then stood up.
They're here, he said.
Daniel's lips were warm and dry. Jack's hand lay on his throat, so he could feel the ragged flutter of Daniel's pulse against his palm. Keeping his eyes closed, he drew back just enough to whisper Daniel's name.
Daniel.
Daniel didn't answer. Jack nuzzled his prickly cheek
slid his hand forward to cup his jaw, and kissed him again. Even the dry, cautious touch of lips to lips made Jack dizzy with desire. Drunk on it. Downright stupid, in fact. Nerve endings sparking like a Van de Graaff generator. Kissing Daniel felt like flying or floating or drowning or dying. He wanted to be rough, to shove Daniel against the door so he could feel all of Daniel's strength pushing back. He wanted to be so achingly tender, Daniel would melt against him, exchanging touches gentle enough to last all night. He wanted to tell Daniel everything. He wanted Daniel to already know, so that neither of them would have to say a word. Daniel did know. He was the one who had come to Jack, after all. He stopped kissing Daniel and whispered, "Thank you." Then opened his eyes to take in the sight of him. Daniel stared back with eyes that were huge with astonishment, flushed and shaking, breathing in surprised, painful-sounding little gasps. Daniel covered his mouth with his fingers, then touched his lower lip and just kept staring at Jack. "Oh," Jack thought. "You know, this is probably what it would have felt like if they'd been caught in the afterburn of that Saturn V launch. A flash of heat so sudden and extreme, the last few electrical impulses in your brain would still be floating around thinking, 'Oh, shit!' a millisecond after you'd already been incinerated." He tried to say, "I'm sorry," but the sheer magnitude of his mistake strangled the words in his throat. He realized his hands were still on Daniel's face, and he pulled them back, turning his palms up in a hopelessly, helplessly inadequate apology. "No," Daniel muttered. He grabbed at Jack's right hand, snagging two fingers in his fist and holding on too hard for Jack to easily escape. "Jack, I don't... I... God, Daniel, I know, I... No, you don't know," Daniel insisted. He released Jack's fingers and then dropped his head and started unbuttoning his own shirt. When the third button caught on a thread, he yanked at it furiously and swore. He wasn't looking at Jack, and his hands were shaking. Jack caught Daniel's trembling hands and eased them away. "Careful," he whispered. "You'll tear your shirt." Daniel gave a nervous stutter of something like laughter. "My shirt." His head finally came up. He hadn't stopped shaking, and his eyes were still wide. "My shirt." His voice was none too steady either. "It's a nice shirt," Jack said. He wasn't sure of anything anymore, but when he brushed his knuckles across Daniel's cheek, Daniel's eyes closed and he drew a long, shaky breath. "I like you in this shirt." Eyes still closed, Daniel almost smiled. "Leave it on for now," Jack whispered. He turned his hand to cradle the side of Daniel's face. "Take it off later if you want." Daniel turned his head and kissed the palm of Jack's hand, and all at once, everything made perfect sense again. They looked at each other, and Daniel practically smiled. Jack opened his arms and tried to grin back, but since he seemed to be on the verge of tears for some damn reason, he wasn't sure how successful a smile it was. Whatever, it worked. Daniel stepped into his arms and laid his head on Jack's shoulder as though it was the most ordinary thing in the world. And when Jack hugged him, Daniel squeezed back hard. God, Daniel, Jack said softly. Daniel was warm and solid in his arms, but Jack could feel goosebumps rising on his own bare legs. For a second there. He slid his arms up Daniel's back and tried to clench his fists in the soft, short hair above the nape of Daniel's neck. Daniel made a quiet sound and lifted his head, and this time when they kissed, Daniel opened his mouth and kissed him back hungrily. It wasn't like Jack's happy dreams. Everything was clumsier. Nothing quite fit. They had to figure out how to hold their heads, butting together blindly with their hands in each other's hair, trying to avoid knocking noses or teeth as they kissed. They were all elbows and knees, and when Jack pushed Daniel against the door to support him while he was sucking the warm flesh just over the collar of Daniel's shirt, the doorknob hit the small of Daniel's back hard enough to make him yelp in protest. Daniel tried to walk them towards the bed, probably figuring they were less likely to hurt themselves if they were lying down, and stepped hard on Jack's bare toes. "I'm sorry," he groaned, laughing and trying to kiss Jack between every word. "I'm sorry. Are you all right?" Jack just hoped no one had called hotel security on them. He dropped down on the end of the bed, holding Daniel's hand, and Daniel sat down beside him and kissed him again. This time he got the angle right on the first try. Jack worked on the third button on Daniel's shirt one-handed as they kissed, but finally he yanked too hard and just broke the thread anyway. The first time he laid his hand on Daniel's bare chest, Daniel broke their kiss with a gasp. Quote, "No door can shut them out. No bolt can turn them back. Through the door, like a snake, they glide. Through the hinge, like the wind, they storm." End quote. The Seven Evil Spirits, R.C. Thompson, translator. The Devils and Evil Spirits of Babylonia, 1903. From the 16th tablet of the Evil Demon series. They look so different out of uniform. Well, Major Davis was still in uniform, so no change there. But Blair might have passed Teal'c and Major Carter on the street without a second glance, both of them in leather jackets and blue jeans, t-shirts, and boots. Teal'c covered his facial tattoo with a Jags cap, and Major Carter had one of the saddlebag purses that were fashionable this year slung over her shoulder. Actually, both of them would still attract second glances, uniforms or no. Blair wondered if Teal'c had picked up the Jags cap his last visit here. "Detective Ellison," Davis said, "I know this must seem like an invasion of your home. I hope we won't be here long." "Dr. Sandberg?" "It is Dr. Sandberg now, isn't it? My congratulations." "Man, glad to know my academic progress is so interesting to the Pentagon," Blair snapped back, which wasn't at all what he'd meant to say. He saw Jim turn his head momentarily, and he shrugged in apology. Really, it had just slipped out. Teal'c inclined his head to Jim and then said,
"Blair Sandberg?"
"Teal'c," Blair said. He was watching Jim, who fell back a step at Teal'c's proximity.
"I am glad to have the opportunity to tell you that I regret the circumstances of our first meeting," Teal'c announced. "I trust you have been well."
"Oh, yeah, fine. Great, actually." "It is good to see you again." Major Carter shook his and Jim's hands in turn, smiling a lower watt version of that astonishing smile of hers.
Actually, this may be the breakthrough we've been waiting for. I've got some ideas about tracking the revenuers, but up until now we haven't had any opportunity to test them. What I'd like to do is set up here first, since we know for certain they were present at least twice on Christmas Day, and then as soon as it gets light, head out to this crime scene, where, Detective Ellison, you sensed their recent presence.
You're going to track them, Jim said. A hint of incredulity colored his words. Creatures that don't even... How in the world do you plan to accomplish that?
His posture was a little stiff, and he was pointedly not looking in Teal'c's direction.
Well, obviously I don't know for sure, but based on our experience with the revenuers, I suspect their manifestations probably generate a distinctive EM field. Specifically, we're probably looking for high-energy particles, protons, maybe some helium nuclei.
Major, Davis interrupted, apologetic and formal. I would think this is on a need-to-know basis only.
What? Blair demanded.
Right, Jim said quietly. If you'll excuse me, Sandberg can help you with anything you need. And without another word, he retreated up the stairs. Blair watched, torn between wanting to follow him and staying to give vent to the frustration that had been building all day.
Venting won out, and he whirled on Davis. I don't believe this. Jim and I were in this thing from the beginning. We've both seen enough to land us in the psych ward a dozen times over, and you still won't tell us squat? Like you said, it's our home that's been invaded and our lives that are being disrupted, and you people are treating us like we're the security risk here.
Davis had a diplomat's smile, neutral and placatory. Even more infuriating to Blair, his eyes were deeply sympathetic.
Technically, yes, you are a security risk.
You've got to be kidding. Jim was a ranger, special ops.
Well, in general, you're considered the greater risk, Dr. Sandberg.
Me?
Some of the wind went out of Blair's sails.
This doesn't have anything to do with my mom, does it?
Davis's smile became genuine.
The intelligence community has a long memory, and I'm afraid Naomi Sandberg's role in distributing copies of the Pentagon Papers while the Ellsbergs were in hiding hasn't been forgotten.
Oh. It shouldn't have been a surprise, but Blair's legs felt rubbery, and he sat down hard on the couch all the same.
Well, cool, he said dully. Mom's pretty proud of that herself.
He took a deep breath. I still don't get treating Jim like this. Not only do you need him, but he's already proved himself 100 times over. He's a hero, man. Don't tell me anyone can question that.
Are you sure you want to discuss this now? I can assure you that we are very grateful to you and Detective Ellison for your assistance, and these are decisions that I had no part in making.
Just the messenger? Right. I hear that.
Tell me anyway.
Major Carter, Teal'c, would you please excuse us for a moment?
Of course. Carter looked startled, but she stood up immediately. We'll just wait in the hall.
What? Blair protested. No, don't go. There's nothing you could tell me that I'm ashamed of. If you're going to say it in front of everyone.
Davis shrugged apologetically. He looked honestly pained.
Again, Please understand these are official policies and have nothing to do with my personal feelings. Then Blair knew what was coming, but he let Major Davis go ahead and say it all the same. Detective Ellison is considered compromised because he's a homosexual. You know that, do you? Blair noticed that his voice didn't really sound like his own anymore. Davis had the grace to hesitate for a moment before saying, "According to the report that was given to me, he's been involved in a sexual relationship with you, at least since the beginning of this year. Is our intelligence wrong?"
"You son of a bitch," Blair said quietly, without real rancor.
He pulled his legs up onto the couch and wrapped his arms around his knees. He desperately wanted to go to Jim, but he wasn't sure he could face him right now.
"Oh, Jesus, man."
Angel was still on his rather desperately mellow kick, Cordelia observed as she stalked into the lobby. And yeah, that was great and all, and it beat the heck out of the not quite evil but such an asshole he might as well be version of the past months. But still, a little of the growly business might not be entirely unwelcome right now. He was sitting behind the reception desk and appeared to be valiantly trying to concentrate on the bookkeeping, while Wes and Gunn practiced their free throws on a basketball net hung from the second-story balustrade. Wesley missed the bounce on the marble floor, and suddenly the ball was caroming straight for Cordelia's face. She caught it handily and passed it to Gunn. "If that had broken a nail, or, God forbid, hit me in the face, none of you would be leaving this room alive. And isn't that net a little high?"
"Cordy," Gunn said cheerfully. "Good to see you too, girl."
He passed the ball to Wesley, who at least had the grace to look faintly abashed, and dropped the ball on a chair. Cordelia ignored him.
"Listen up, people. I have an announcement to make."
"Is something the matter?"
Angel put aside the ledger.
"Oh, you could say that, all right. The dress rehearsal for King in Yellow is tomorrow night, and I swear to God the whole thing is a total and complete disaster. People don't know their lines, they're missing their cues, screwing up the blocking. It's like some kind of horrible, horrible nightmare. It got so bad that even I wasn't hitting my mark, which was absolutely not my fault, because what am I supposed to do when everyone else is blundering around like the pathetic, whiny amateurs they are? God!" She sat down hard on the nearest sofa and waited.
Silence. The three men exchanged glances.
"Well," Wes finally ventured,
"isn't it a bit of old show business lore that a poor dress rehearsal portends an excellent opening night?"
"Well, yes,"
Cordelia agreed with exaggerated patience.
"But this isn't the dress rehearsal. This is me having spent 8 weeks of my life on a production that isn't going to get me any recognition at all, except maybe recognition for being the biggest idiot in the lamest show of the season."
Another silence. Then Angel said, carefully,
"Does that mean you'd rather we didn't come to opening night?"
If Cordelia hadn't known better, she would almost have thought his tone sounded faintly hopeful.
"Oh, no," she announced firmly. "If I'm going down in flames,
I expect my friends to be there afterwards to pick up the pieces. Then she felt a sudden, sharp instant of disorientation. Earthquake, she thought, and she looked up to see if the chandeliers were swaying. Hey, did you guys...
Mixed metaphor, Cordy,
Angel interrupted. He was rising from behind the reception desk.
But we can do pieces, if that's what you really want.
Something about his tone sent a cold shiver up her spine. Excuse me, she snapped, frightened without knowing why. I was saying something here. Angel continued to rise, and something was definitely very, very wrong, because Angel was a tall guy, but he wasn't that tall. Either he was levitating, or his legs were growing longer, and really, neither was a particularly acceptable alternative.
Angel? She whispered.
Then, although she didn't see him move, suddenly he was standing on the reception desk, and he held a broadsword in both hands. She heard Wesley shout in protest, but it would have been more helpful if he'd done something, anything, even pitched the damn basketball. Angel swooped down, his heavy blade cleaving the air. She heard the wind of its passing, but didn't feel the sword at her throat. When Daniel first awoke, he thought he was simply tangled up in the sheets. He tried gingerly to free himself without disturbing Jack, but eventually realized the problem wasn't the bedclothes. His own pants were bunched around his ankles, and he was still wearing his shoes. He dropped his head back on the pillow. So, the two of them had popped off like a couple of teenagers, and then immediately fallen asleep, like the not teenagers anymore they really were. He thought he should probably be embarrassed, but the most he could feel was a sense of faint bemusement. That, and a sweet, sweet warmth that would probably make him cry if he thought about it too much. He didn't know if kissing Jack back last night had been the bravest or the most cowardly thing he'd ever done. But he didn't regret it. He would have done anything to wipe that expression of crestfallen mortification off Jack's face. Happily gone to the ends of the galaxy to bring back Jack's shy smile. Jack didn't want him to go to the ends of the galaxy, though. He just wanted to give Daniel kisses that were as tender as his dear Shari's had been. It turned out he was pretty much okay with that, Daniel thought to himself in the darkness, dazed but happy. The bare memory of Jack's hands on his body made him feel electrified. He remembered Jack's shaky laughter as they tried to wrestle Daniel out of his clothes, and Jack's sigh of contentment and pleasure when they wrapped themselves around each other. He remembered lying belly to belly with Jack, heaving and stroking and kissing with frantic eagerness, and he wanted to wake Jack up and try everything all over again, and more. Maybe without the shoes this time. Instead, he resigned himself to lying awake in the wet spot with his shoes on, as Jack slumbered beside him. This wasn't so bad at all, not really, because who knew what the morning would bring? They probably needed to talk, and then this could all be over. Best to enjoy the moment while it lasted. Time must have passed, though Daniel wasn't aware of it, because he felt his body suddenly flinch, as though he were on the verge of dropping off to sleep. Jack stirred beside him and put his hand on Daniel's shoulder.
Hey, Daniel whispered happily, and Jack murmured something in return and spooned up behind him, draping one arm over Daniel's waist and burying his face against the juncture of his neck and shoulder. Jack felt wonderful, his ticklish breath sending goosebumps down his spine. The warmth of his body snuggled up close, chasing the shivers away again. Daniel arched and pressed eagerly back and didn't resist when Jack eased him over onto his stomach and pulled him up to his knees. He felt a flutter of fear, but it was subsumed by a dizzying swell of desire. Jack slid one hand down, his fingers cold and slick enough to make Daniel flinch. He stroked and pressed until Daniel relaxed into his touch, and he spread his other hand across Daniel's chest. Daniel began to tremble and look down at himself, and although the room was in darkness, he could see Jack's hand glowing with a faint phosphorescence. Of course, he realized an instant later, that wasn't Jack's hand at all. The fingers were pudgy and soft and cold as the grave, and the face pressed against Daniel's neck was flabby and utterly featureless. No jawline, no cheekbone, no nose. The genitals slapping against the back of his thigh were a wet, limply malformed wad of flesh, and despite Daniel's frantic struggles, the thing at his back continued to pad and pet him with mute, blind persistence. He bucked violently, hampered by his tethered ankles, and tried to scream. From somewhere nearby, he heard Jack's voice, and with a final, wild effort, managed to fling himself out of bed. He hit the floor with a thud that knocked the breath out of him. The room seemed to pitch forward, and then lean, muscular arms were around him, pulling him up, holding him close. Daniel, that wasn't me, Jack moaned in a hoarse voice, hugging him desperately. I swear to Christ, that wasn't me. When Blair finally came upstairs, he found Jim stretched out on the bed, shoes kicked off and one arm flung across his eyes. He swung his legs around and sat up at Blair's approach. Jim! Blair spread his hands helplessly. He couldn't imagine what to say. Jim smiled at him, albeit ruefully. Ready to get on that plane to Vermont now? He asked. God, Jim! Blair couldn't laugh. Did you know? He shrugged. I thought it was a possibility. I'm sorry, Chief. I had no idea it would blindside you like this. No, I should have known. Oh, man, I'm so fucking naive. It never even crossed my mind. When you said things could get bad, I thought you meant, you know, bullets and ray guns. Still a possibility. It'd almost be a relief at this point, Blair said miserably. He dropped onto the edge of the bed beside Jim. I can't believe. I'm sorry, I should have known. I'm so sorry. Stop it. You've got nothing to be sorry for. But you... No. Jim leaned forward and kissed him with slow deliberation. Blair worried at first that they could be seen from downstairs, but then he thought, to hell with it, and kissed Jim back. Feeling suddenly lightheaded, he fell more deeply into the kiss. Jim was the one who suddenly sat back. Jim? He held up a quieting hand, and Blair shut up. God damn them, Jim snapped. Stay here, he ordered peremptorily. What? What's going on?
Just stay here.
Jim was already halfway down the stairs.
You bastards, he was saying in a flat voice. You fucking bastards.
Detective Ellison, Davis said calmly, I'm going to have to ask you to put down your weapon and stay right where you are.
Jim stopped. I'm not carrying.
From where he stood at the railing, Blair saw the front door suddenly flung open wide, and he heard the back door being smashed down a moment later. The living room filled with armed, uniformed men. Detective, Davis repeated, please don't make this any more difficult than it already is. I know you don't want Dr. Sandberg to get hurt.
I don't want anyone to get hurt, Jim said, talking just as calmly and slowly as Davis.
He raised his hands, but otherwise stood absolutely still.
Just tell me what you need me to do.
Put down your weapon.
He doesn't have a weapon, Blair insisted. His service revolver is up here on the dresser.
At that, all the guns in the place swung up to point in Blair's direction. Every soldier's face was dimpled and gray, without eyes or nose or mouth.
Jim! He cried in horror, and he saw quick flashes of light and heard thunder.
His legs gave out, and he sat down hard on the floor. Jim was screaming, and Blair wanted to reassure him, but he couldn't manage to form words.
Stand down! Davis was yelling. Damn it! Stand down! Don't shoot the sentinel!
Thank God, Blair thought, weak with relief. He was hurting and desperately tired. His hand hovered before the blood spatters across his chest. Jim was at his side an instant later.
Ah, oh, Chief, he whispered.
He put his hands on Blair's shoulders and eased him down. Take it easy. You're going to be just fine.
I know, Blair murmured.
He closed his eyes, hearing Jim shout for paramedics. Then he felt Jim's cheek laid against his own, heard him whispering.
Hang on, Blair, please. Please.
He tried to tell Jim that he loved him, but his tongue was too thick in his mouth to form words. The world had begun to sway, and Blair supposed this was death. And frankly, man, once again, it sucked. The world stopped. He drew a breath of air that didn't hurt and opened his eyes. Jim jerked upright above him and stared down at him.
Sandberg?
His eyes filled with sudden tears, and he snatched Blair up in a bone-crushing hug. Blair patted his back weakly.
I'm okay, he said, amazed. I thought I got shot.
Jim, those soldiers. Jim released him slowly, cupping Blair's face with his hands for a moment, then spreading his right hand over his chest. There were no bullet holes. There was no blood.
They're not here, Jim said.
Footsteps came pounding up the stairs. Davis, Teal'c, and Carter.
Dr. Sandberg, Davis panted.
Amazingly, he still held onto shreds of his diplomatic reserve.
You're not hurt.
No, Blair said. He stumbled to his feet with Jim's help. Jim turned on them.
What the hell are you people playing at?
For his part, Blair was pretty certain that Major Davis had no more idea what was going on than he or Jim. His face was dead white, and the way he was leaning against the wall, he'd probably be on the floor by now without its support.
"I didn't give that order," Davis said, his voice wavering just a little.
"I don't know who those men were."
"I do not believe those were real airmen," Teal'c announced seriously. "For one thing, they appeared to have no faces."
The lobby spun around and around Cordelia, and when it finally came to a rest, Angel had already killed Gunn. Old habits died hard, and Angel had used the broadsword to stake him through the heart, even though, with a weapon that size, a thrust anywhere through the torso presumably would have done the trick. Gunn was only human. He lay sprawled on the marble floor, sightless eyes staring up at the basketball net hanging from the balustrade. At least Cordelia hoped his eyes were sightless. After all, she could still see, and it was just profoundly, fundamentally wrong that anyone should ever be able to observe the curve of her back and the soles of her own shoes from across the room.
"You bastard!"
Wesley was red-faced and weeping with rage. "You monstrous, godless, inhuman bastard!" He flung himself weaponless at Angel, and Cordelia prayed it would be over quickly.
"Wanna play?"
Angel smiled. He dropped the sword and clotheslined Wesley, forearm to the throat. Wes dropped like a stone. Angel knelt over him, still smiling.
"This is what you wanted all along, isn't it?"
he asked, his hands plucking at Wesley's fly. Wesley fought back furiously until Angel yanked his shirt up and punched two fingers into the fresh scar under his ribs. Wes couldn't even scream. He grunted, writhing weakly as Angel yanked his jeans down and pushed his knee back to his chest.
"Guess this is your lucky day,"
Angel said as he lowered his head. He took his time, chewing through the soft flesh of Wesley's inner thigh. Someone walked up to the two of them on the floor and stood over them without interfering as Wesley thrashed in agony. All Cordelia could see of the stranger were his worn shoes and baggy, colorless pants, the cuffs trampled and dirty. At last, a bright fountain of arterial blood spouted upward, rising and falling in time with the beating of Wesley's failing heart. Cordelia felt a hard jolt, and when she opened her eyes again, all she could see was the marble floor, which was not all that clean, but at least it wasn't awash in blood, like she expected. She tried to push herself to a sitting position before remembering she couldn't do that anymore. But to her astonished relief, her limbs obeyed her after all. It still wasn't easy to find the courage to look over her shoulder. Gunn was sitting up as slowly as she had done, his hand on his unskewered chest. Angel was huddled up a short distance from Wes, slack-jawed and crazy-eyed with shock. And Wes wasn't much better, still lying on his back and weeping softly, rubbing his palm in disbelief back and forth over the unblemished flesh of his thigh. She averted her eyes to give him privacy, realizing at the same time that she didn't seem to be able to stop touching her own throat to reassure herself she was still in one piece. There was no sign of the stranger.
So, okay, she said at last, because it didn't look like anybody else was planning to speak up any time soon. What the hell was that all about?
Quote, when I was small, I was at the academy, where I learned the scribal art from the tablets of Sumer and Akkad. None of the nobles could write on clay as I could. There, where people regularly went for tutelage in the scribal art, I qualified fully in subtraction, addition, reckoning, and accounting. The fair Nanabgal, Nisaba, provided me amply with knowledge and comprehension. I am an experienced scribe who does not neglect a thing. End quote. A praise poem of Shulgi, Shulgi B.
Well, Teal'c certainly hadn't mentioned that part of Jaffa Ahmet legends, Daniel thought. In fact, Teal'c had said things wouldn't get really bad until the Ahmet started to get chatty. Lovely thought there that the worst was yet to come. Another hard, involuntary shudder of revulsion snaked down Daniel's spine, and Jack tightened his arm around his shoulders and then pretended to be simply adjusting the blanket.
Come on, hold it together, he said gently.
I'm okay, Daniel nodded quickly. I'm okay, just a little surprised.
Makes two of us, Jack muttered.
Christ!
Daniel squeezed his eyes shut. He was trying to remember what his life had been like before Shifu's dream and before the light, but he no longer had any clear recollection of who that Daniel Jackson could have been. What had he thought about before falling asleep at night? When he first awoke in the morning? What had he dreamed about? He remembered his grief for Shari, and a creeping sense of shame as the passage of time inevitably dulled the sharp, hot horror of her death. But he couldn't remember or even imagine what else had filled his mind during those months besides work. Had there been anything? Now, when he closed his eyes, he saw the terrible spaces between the stars. And when he dreamed of the temple on P3X-636 and of the thing that slept in darkness. And when he awoke, he thought first of how he would see the Go'uld humbled once more by their ancient hosts.
Come on, Daniel, look at me.
Daniel opened his eyes. Jack must be going nuts with impatience, but after coaxing Daniel into telling him whether the thing in their bed was really gone, and if there was any hope of chasing or catching it, he had bundled Daniel into a blanket and was waiting for Daniel to tell him the rest. He even believed Daniel would tell him the truth. In fact, Daniel thought, with a bleak sense of wonder, despite everything, Jack looked at this hollow man and saw someone that he wanted. Maybe even loved.
You in there? Jack asked.
Daniel honestly didn't know, but he nodded.
We need to tell Carter and Teal'c about that thing. They have to know what we're dealing with as soon as possible.
I know, Daniel whispered, just as Jack's cell phone began to ring on the bedside table.
It was chilly on the balcony at 2 a.m.
Blair crossed his arms over his chest and wished he'd grabbed a sweater before stepping out. The window opened behind him, and for a moment the sounds from their living room washed over him. Davis and Carter, both on the phone. The instruments set up beside the staircase, beeping and humming. Blair thought the magnetic fields in the radiation detectors were probably bothering Jim, but when he'd asked about them, Jim had snapped that they weren't nearly as annoying as Blair wearing a hole through the floor with his pacing. Then he'd yanked Blair back and hugged him hard, once again laying his hand over Blair's chest to reassure himself before letting him go. Blair could take a hint all the same. Teal'c stepped out onto the balcony behind Blair. Closing the window, he announced, "The smell of salt water is quite refreshing." Blair couldn't help a faint smile. "Yeah." Teal'c interpreted this as an invitation and took up a position beside him at the brick balustrade.
"Are you recovered from the effects of our shared hallucination?"
"Is that what they're calling it now?"
"That is what Major Davis is calling the experience. Major Carter has expressed concern that such nomenclature is a contradiction in terms."
"She's probably right, but I'm fine."
"And Detective Ellison as well?"
"He's great, too."
"You are angry," Teal'c observed.
"No, I'm not." "Okay, I am. Or maybe not so much angry as frustrated."
"That is certainly an understandable emotional response."
A pause, and then Teal'c tried again.
"Detective Ellison is frustrated as well."
"Actually, I think his background gives him a little more patience in dealing with the military than I have."
"He is uncomfortable around me."
Blair was momentarily surprised by the observation. "Maybe," he finally agreed.
"He is aware of my symbiote."
Blair shrugged. "He's seen it, so yeah, he's aware of it."
"I was referring to his heightened senses. I have wondered whether he is actually capable of hearing or otherwise perceiving its presence."
Blair stared out towards the bay, thinking about the fact that these people knew so damn much about Jim and wouldn't share anything of themselves.
"You've read my dissertation?"
"I have."
"Huh. Detective Ellison is a true warrior."
Not an assessment of Jim's life and abilities that Blair particularly liked. But clearly, Teal'c intended it as a high compliment. So he nodded instead of protesting.
"And you love him deeply."
"Well, Teal'c certainly seemed to specialize in conversation stoppers." Blair finally managed. "I do." And then, "That's not in the dissertation."
"On the contrary."
Teal'c stood at parade rest, looking out at the night lights on the bay.
"Your high regard is entirely apparent throughout."
"Excuse me." The window had opened again, and this time Major Carter stood on the threshold. "Dr. Sandberg, if you don't mind, I need to ask you a few more questions about your sighting in front of the supermarket the other morning."
"It's Blair. That's what you were calling me before."
Blair turned away, feeling a slightly absurd impulse to shake Teal'c's hand. I'll be right there.
The agony was quite overwhelming, Wesley said thoughtfully. The sensation of teeth tearing through my flesh was very nearly enough to...
Do you have to do that? Angel snapped.
He leaned over the desk and pulled the little dictaphone from Wesley's hand, snapping off the record button before giving it back to him.
That was uncalled for, Wesley protested.
Angel immediately looked guilty.
Everyone already knows what happened, he mumbled in his defense.
Ah, but that's the thing. Right now it may be clear enough in our minds, but visions and manifestations are notoriously difficult to retain over the long term with any degree of clarity. Confronted with the patently impossible, the human mind almost immediately begins to construct alternative explanations. Therefore, it's vitally important that we capture our first impressions as accurately as possible.
Two things, Angel said. First of all, I'm not human, so I don't have a human mind. And secondly, what we saw, what we experienced, isn't exactly impossible.
Tell me about it,
Cordelia agreed, with perhaps more feeling than the situation demanded.
What?
She asked when everyone turned to look at her. It's not like Angel's inner Hannibal Lecter is some big secret or something.
Cordy's right, Angel said. I've got to get away from here.
Wait a minute, man.
Gunn stood up quickly.
What do you mean by that?
I mean I'm packing up my old kit bag and I'm getting the hell out of Dodge. That was obviously a prophecy, some kind of warning.
Wait, wait, wait!
Cordelia got in front of Angel before he could ascend the stairs.
You can't just leave. That's crazy.
No, he said patiently. Crazy would be waiting around here until the prophecy comes true.
Oh, you're just going to leave so that when you turn all evil, you'll be chowing down on complete strangers instead of on your friends? Well, maybe the part of me that hopes I don't get my head lopped off is all for that. But on the other hand, Angel, come on.
Her voice softened.
It sort of defeats the whole concept of, you know, helping the helpless. That whole hero gig, you know?
Angel looked away from her.
And we really have no evidence at all that what we experienced was a warning, much less a prophecy, Wesley pressed on.
That person, that faceless creature who was standing above us, who was he? What did his presence mean?
We simply don't have enough information to do anything more than hypothesize at this point.
Know something? Gunn said.
I'm sure that wasn't no prophecy. Think about it. In real life, there just ain't no way Angel could have taken me down.
Denver's Books and Esoterica was in a storefront just off Hollywood Boulevard. Jack had to drive nearly 4 blocks north to find a parking place, finally stopping in front of an apartment building whose crumbling Moorish face was almost completely hidden by overgrown clumps of banana trees. Only then, once he'd put the rental car in park, did he finally say what he'd been thinking all this time.
That damned monster was in your room?
Daniel sighed to himself.
Of all the times for Jack to decide to talk.
He had told most of the truth when Sam called last night with news of their own sighting, and Jack had sat on the bed and stared at him
like he'd never seen Daniel before in his life. Afterwards, he'd brusquely ordered him to go to sleep and said that he would wake Daniel up in 2 hours to take the last watch of the night, as if they were on an alien world instead of in a Santa Monica hotel room. True to his word, Jack had awakened him from a surprisingly sound sleep 2 hours later, and Daniel had waited for dawn, sitting in an uncomfortable hotel room chair, while Jack slumbered alone in the bed where they'd made love. In the morning, they went running along the boardwalk again, and then negated the healthful benefits of their jog by having coffee and beignets for breakfast. They checked in with Carter once more before driving to Hollywood, and Jack barely said 2 words about last night.
Until now.
Christ, Daniel, you let me lay some cheap moves on you because I'm too damn stupid to tell the difference between bedroom eyes and sheer terror.
Jack, why didn't you say something?
What the hell were you thinking?
I don't know. Probably that I wasn't about to turn down the best offer I'd had in about 5 years.
Jack snorted. Taking off his sunglasses, he rubbed his eyes with his fingers as though he were suddenly very tired.
Crazy as a fucking loon. You've been seeing that thing for weeks now? Months? And you didn't tell me?
It was getting hot, sitting in the car. Daniel swung his door open.
Yeah, well, you know what happens to loons.
Oh, for Christ's sake. Jack started to reach for him, but let his hand drop. That's why he'd chosen to do this in public, Daniel thought. So there would be no touching, no shouting.
Daniel,
Jack tried again, his voice sounding stilted with swallowed hurt.
Marcello's bugs, you said you'd forgiven me.
No, you said you didn't blame me.
And I don't.
I never blamed you. You were trying to take care of me, I know that. And if I'd told you I'd started hallucinating 8 or 10 weeks ago, maybe the best way to take care of me would have been to lock me away from my books. But this was just too important to let you do that, Jack.
I'm more certain than ever. The Revenuers could be the key to defeating the Goa'uld once and for all. So don't tell me that you, of all people, can't appreciate how that's more important than any personal considerations.
He got out of the car without waiting for Jack to answer, but when he turned around to pull his briefcase out of the back, Jack was still sitting rigid behind the steering wheel, his face as neutral as he could make it. But it turned out it wasn't just your private hallucination, Jack said.
You don't know what's going on. Nobody knows what's going on now. In fact, you may have endangered us all and God knows how many innocents by deciding you knew how to handle this all by yourself.
I didn't think anyone else would ever see it. As an excuse, Daniel had to admit, that sounded pretty weak.
Newsflash, Danny. You were wrong.
I know that now.
Do you? Do you really? 1 minute you're all curled up next to me.
Jack's voice dropped to less than a whisper.
And the next it's like I'm trapped in this fucking nightmare. I was praying it was a nightmare. You were so trusting and I couldn't warn you.
Jack broke off. He wrestled the key out of the ignition with entirely unnecessary force, swung himself out of the rental car, and slammed the door behind himself. Hey, Daniel said. I'm all right.
Well, maybe I'm not, Jack snarled back, and took off, stalking back down the street to the bookstore.
Daniel followed him without a word. The tiny store was sandwiched between a pawn shop and a guitar store, its front door and windows so covered with flyers and community announcements for HIV-positive support groups and tarot readings, band appearances and poetry nights, that Daniel could barely see the bookshelves within. He tried the door and found it locked. He said he'd be here by 9. Jack looked at his watch and then knocked.
And anyway, Daniel said quietly, as a figure came around the stacks and approached the door from within.
They weren't cheap moves, Jack. They were nice.
Jack's head snapped around, and for a moment, the expression in his eyes was so open and surprised, Daniel wanted to kiss him right there on the street. He made do with a smile, and Jack muttered, "Really?" and almost smiled back. The man in the bookstore unlocked the front door, but didn't open it for them. After a moment's hesitation, Daniel pushed the door open himself and stuck his head in. "Hello?" The bookstore seemed very dim after the bright April sunshine, and it took Daniel's eyes a moment to adjust. The shop was long and narrow. Bookshelves lined the walls 2 stories high, a spiral staircase in a back corner climbing to a catwalk that ran around the upper levels. At Daniel's greeting, the ginger-haired man who had unlocked the door for them hunched his shoulders and didn't look back.
"If you're waiting for an invitation," he said, "you're going to be waiting out there for a damn long time."
Daniel exchanged a shrug with Jack and then stepped in.
"Mr. Denver, I'm Daniel Jackson. We talked yesterday. This is Jack O'Neill, and
I talked to you yesterday," the man snapped, finally turning around. He had pale blue eyes and could have been any age between 40 and 60. "Denver was my partner. He's been dead for 2 months now."
"Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know. So you're..."
"He was staked by a vampire," the man said.
"Isn't it usually the other way around?" Jack asked cheerfully. Daniel shot him a look, and Jack shrugged, unrepentant. Denver's former partner didn't take offense.
"A vampire with a sense of irony," he agreed. "That's when you're in trouble. Most of them are just predators, you know. Stupid, hungry animals. But every now and then the dark side of nature throws up a sport like that evil bitch. She didn't even feed on him."
Jack had begun humming the Twilight Zone theme very, very softly to himself. Daniel pressed on, raising his voice slightly.
"I'm very sorry about your partner."
I guess I didn't get your name."
"Bill," said the ginger-haired man. "I didn't correct you yesterday because I don't always feel like talking about Denver. I'm Bill Rice."
"I appreciate your taking the time to meet us. Do you have the Ishikido manuscript here?"
"Beautiful piece. Ancient Sumerian on translucent green alabaster. 5x5 columns. 103 lines of formal, archaizing, cuneiform script of extremely high quality."
It's been tentatively dated at around 3100 BCE.
You mind telling me how you heard about it originally, Dr. Jackson?
It's cross-referenced in Miskatonic's collection catalog. I understand Randolph Carter deeded it to Denver's father in the early 1930s.
Gift from one scholar to another, Bill said, his expression becoming somewhat more gentle. This way.
He led Daniel and Jack back, past stacks of books and magazines, incense, crystals, and other less identifiable paraphernalia, and finally around a Japanese screen at the back of the store, which partitioned off a very small living area. There was a neatly made-up camp bed in the corner with a tiny sink beside it, a 4x4-foot office safe that probably dated back to the Depression, and a roll-top desk, too crammed with papers to ever be shut. Stacked on top of the safe were a hot pad and an electric kettle, red cans of soup, and a jar of instant coffee.
Daniel thought about a 5,000-year-old manuscript being kept in these surroundings and had to clench his teeth to avoid making any comment. Jack, on the other hand, was looking more cheerful than Daniel had seen him all morning, and Daniel suspected it was because he never, ever intended to let Daniel forget this.
Here we go.
Bill swung open the safe and pulled out a leather-bound notebook with yellowing pages, which he handed to Daniel with a flourish. Daniel took it dubiously, looked down at it, and then back at Bill.
This isn't the Ishikidu manuscript.
Yes, it is.
Daniel turned the notebook in his hand. No, it isn't.
I'm no archaeologist, Jack drawled, but that doesn't look like translucent green alabaster to me.
It's Randolph Carter's own transcription. It's not generally known that he was an excellent draftsman, in addition to his other skills.
Daniel opened the book at random. True to the bookseller's word, the pages were covered with painstakingly careful pencil sketches of a cuneiform tablet.
Mr. Rice, Daniel said carefully.
Bill, I flew here from Colorado because I understood you had the Ishikidu manuscript itself and that you were prepared to let me examine it. Not to see a reproduction, no matter how well done.
Randolph Carter's notes are completely accurate, down to the last verbal infix.
Randolph Carter also believed the Salem graveyards were infested with flesh-eating ghouls.
Daniel was trying hard not to lose his temper.
Surely you can understand that without being able to judge the authenticity of the original manuscript for myself, much less the accuracy of Carter's copy, these notes are useless to me.
You expected me to just show you the Ishikidu manuscript?
Daniel shot a quick glance at Jack, who was rocking back on his heels, hands in his pockets, and a placid, not smile on his face, obviously enjoying this whole thing far too much.
Yes, actually, I did.
All right. Bill threw his hands in the air. Someone calls me up out of the blue, claiming to be Daniel Jackson.
Claiming to be? Jack mouthed to Daniel, his eyebrows going up. Obviously, from Jack's point of view, this just kept getting better and better.
Asked to see a fantastically rare and dangerous magical text, and I'm supposed to just have it here in the shop waiting for him?
Daniel blinked, considering. Would you like to see some ID?
The bell over the front door of the shop jingled, but Bill paid no attention to it, dismissing Daniel's offer with a contemptuous wave of his hand.
Like the government couldn't mock up any kind of identification you wanted.
Bill, called a voice from the front of the shop. Are you home?
I'm taking a tremendous risk, even showing you Carter's notes.
Bill snatched them back out of Daniel's hands.
I think it's time for you to go now. And don't bother sending any more government spooks.
Bill? The customer had made his way to the back of the shop. What's going on?
These gentlemen were just leaving.
Now, wait a minute, Jack finally interrupted.
I'm sure if everyone just calms down, we can get this whole thing straightened out. If you don't get out of my shop right now, I'm calling the police.
Oh, my goodness, said the new customer, and Daniel glanced around at him for the first time. Tall and thin, with a slight limp and the pallor of a man getting over a long illness. He was in blue jeans and a two-day-old beard, but the linen shirt tucked into his jeans was freshly ironed, and if the points on his collar were any way to judge, probably starched as well.
"Bill, this really is Daniel Jackson," the stranger exclaimed.
"I thought that was you last night at the Raj, Dr. Jackson, but I wasn't absolutely positive, or I certainly would have introduced myself then." He stuck out his hand. Somewhat dazedly, Daniel shook hands with the man.
"This is such an honor," the stranger said.
"Wesley Wyndham Price, at your service, sir."
Quote, "No place let it remain in one number. Add and diminish until the stars be numbered. Arise, move, and appear before the covenant of his mouth, which he hath sworn unto us in his justice. Open the mysteries of your creation, and make us partakers of the undefiled knowledge." End quote. John D., 1527-1608. The Calls of the 30 Ethers.
"I feel like a goddamn bloodhound," Jim growled. It was his first complaint all morning, and Blair was relieved to hear it. Frankly, the way Jim had been quietly going along with whatever the feds asked him to do had been starting to freak him out.
"Personally," Blair murmured back happily, "I'm still waiting to see a full-blown Sherlock Holmes routine from you. You know, throwing yourself to the ground and following a scent on your belly."
"You can just keep waiting," Jim said, but Blair thought he saw a quick smile all the same.
Then Jim's head twitched fractionally, and he put his hand to the side of his head.
"What?"
Jim's lips thinned.
"Nothing."
"Their instruments are bugging you, aren't they?"
"Maybe. I don't know. Carter said the electrical fee—"
"I know, I heard. She thinks that if you can watch a color TV, then you shouldn't be bothered by the electrical field her muon detector's putting out. But you know what, man? She doesn't know squat about sentinels. And besides, you're not usually watching television while you're trying to track signs of extraterrestrial life. I'm going to tell her to turn the damn thing off." Jim nodded once, and Blair squeezed his arm. "Just hang on for me, okay?" He turned and jogged back to join the rest of their little parade. Carter, Teal'c, and Davis were several hundred feet back, and further back still were the lead detective on the case and the captain of the 8th Precinct, as well as the patrolman who'd been first on the scene 2 days ago. Their procession through the alleys and backyards of Tacoma Heights had attracted an audience,
and people were standing on their front porches and watching through their windows with frank curiosity. Quite the parade. No wonder Jim was feeling self-conscious.
"Hey,"
he said, when he was close enough to talk without shouting. "Your gadget's bothering Jim. You're going to have to turn that off if you want him to have a hope of finding anything." Carter looked simultaneously fascinated and disappointed. She turned the small gray device in her hand.
"Are you sure it's not something else in the environment? I'd prefer to have a real-time confirmation of anything that Detective Ellison finds."
"No, it's your detector."
"Speaking of, I've been to the astrophysics lab at Rainier a time or two, and the toys they use to measure cosmic rays fill up a room. And you expect me to believe you can do the same thing with something that looks like a PDA?"
She grinned from ear to ear. "It's hard for me to believe sometimes, too. When I was just a year out of the academy, I spent 3 months on an icebreaker cruising up near the Arctic Circle. We had a neutrino monitor on board, and I thought it was just about the coolest thing in the world."
Blair had to smile back. "Sounds like big fun, all right."
Then he caught a glimpse of movement out of the corner of his eye. Spinning around, he took off running as hard as he could. He heard Teal'c shout, but all Blair could pay attention to was the sight of Jim on the ground, both arms flung up over his face.
Oh, God, he told Jim to stay put.
He ran into a spider web spun across the alley just as he reached Jim. He ignored it, falling to his knees at Jim's side. But as he reached out for him, he suddenly realized the fine strands of the web hadn't brushed across his face at all. Sticky threads of memory and vision ghosted across his mind, and he saw the oyster-faced soldiers raising their guns in the darkness of the pre-dawn sky over the grocery store parking lot. Music was playing, a song from a corny old musical, and in the shadows, something which had lain sleeping for a very long time finally began to stir. It wasn't a spider web. It was ice. Infinitesimal shards darting through his mind like the neutrinos Major Carter was trying to detect. And he would have told her, "Here, they're right here, and they're tearing me to shreds." But he couldn't talk. Not while he was trying to get to Jim. The sharp fragments of vision ended as suddenly as they'd begun.
"Jim," he croaked.
Warm hands cradled his head.
"Do not attempt to move."
"Jim,"
Blair said again, thrashing a little as he tried to get up. He could see a chain-link fence and Teal'c's downturned face and the haze of clouds that covered the sky.
"Damn it, where's Jim?"
"He is here."
Teal'c stopped trying to restrain him and helped him up, his arm around Blair's shoulders. True to Teal'c's word, Jim was on the ground beside him with Major Davis crouched nearby. Davis had one hand on Jim's shoulder, the other under his skull, to protect his head from the pavement, and he was undoubtedly ruining that razor-sharp crease in his trousers.
"Easy," Davis said.
He looked white with shock or surprise, but his voice was level.
"Please take it easy, Detective Ellison. Help will be here in just a minute. Major Carter, do you have anything?"
"I'm checking," she said, but Blair ignored them all, crawling to Jim's side. Jim's eyes were open, and he managed a crooked smile for Blair.
"Chief." "God damn it," Blair groaned in relief.
He took Jim's hand in both his own and clutched it against his chest.
"Are you all right?"
"Little dizzy," Jim conceded in a hoarse voice.
"Headache,"
Sandberg, they've called for paramedics. I can hear the siren. Get them to send them away. I can't handle... I know you don't like it, but I'd rather have you checked out. Please, man. I'm all right. Help me sit up. I don't think that's a good idea, Davis said, his voice unexpectedly firm. I felt the tail end of that myself, and I'm no sentinel.
Indeed, Teal'c agreed.
He wasn't making any moves to stand up either. Are you all right? Carter asked.
My symbiote is extremely agitated. Did you obtain any documentation of what happened here?
No, darn it. No, I don't have anything but normal background radiation. And I was so sure we could track the phenomenon.
Help me sit up, Jim demanded again. I don't want to...
He broke off, and Blair leaned down close.
You don't want to what?
I don't want to lie here looking up at the sky, Jim muttered in a half-shamed whisper, and Blair understood that 100%. He nodded to Davis, and the two of them eased Jim up. As soon as he was sitting, he became visibly calmer. Davis, on the other hand, was wide-eyed and anything but calm.
Dr. Sandberg, I don't want to look up at the sky either.
What the hell's going on here?
You're asking me?
Davis lifted his hand, palm up, to demonstrate it was still shaking.
I've never felt anything like that. It was like something physical, but it shook loose all these memories, images, things I've never seen before. And now...
He wiped the back of his hand across his mouth.
Damn it, this must be what agoraphobia is like. I can't shake the feeling that there's something up there.
I didn't feel anything. Carter sounded disappointed. I got here just a second later, and I didn't feel a thing.
It's splintered, Jim said quietly. Yesterday it was this discrete blob of something, of nothing. And today it's a million pieces all over the place. Worse, like it's breaking up existence as it goes.
Jim propped his elbows on his knees and buried his face in his hands.
Listen to me. Jesus, I sound like a lunatic.
I felt it too. Blair put his hand on Jim's shoulder. If you're crazy, then we're all going down together here.
Jim looked up.
If I were you, he said bleakly to Davis, I'd be checking local hospitals and psych wards. We may not be the only ones experiencing this. The same with what happened last night.
A concrete goal seemed to buck Major Davis right up. He gave a tight nod. You're right. If there's a public health threat, we need to document it as soon as possible.
Look, Blair interrupted, because he had to try. You felt that. So did Teal'c. So did I. Obviously, you don't need Jim to play canary in the mineshaft anymore. So while you're on the phone to your superiors, why don't you let them know you can carry on without our help? Okay?
Sandberg.
Jim shook his head a little.
You felt that. If there's anything...
But Jim...
If there's anything I can do to help, you know I have to try.
I'm sure you don't remember, Wesley continued enthusiastically, but I saw you give a lecture at Queen's while I was reading classics.
This must have been, 92, maybe? 93?
Your critique of Sethus Hieroglyphische Urkunden der Griechischen Römischen Zeit was absolutely devastating. He grinned at the memory. I don't know if anyone ever told you, that was one of the required texts for examination that year. Professor Baines was sitting in the corner, fuming all the way through your talk.
Oh, I heard about it, Daniel said dryly. He tried to have me banned from Griffith Library.
I can hardly believe the man could have been so petty over an academic dispute, Wesley disagreed.
But did he really? Incredible.
Bill, hearing Dr. Jackson speak was practically a life-changing experience for me. I'm quite serious. We'd all been saying for years that Colonel Howard Weiss's inscriptions in the King's Chamber had to have been a forgery. But it took someone with Dr. Jackson's credentials to finally be taken seriously. Considering his work in ancient Egyptian, not to mention his role in reopening KV-5, and his work in early airborne site mapping, when this man stood up and told the world the Fourth Dynasty pharaohs didn't build the Great Pyramids, the academic community finally had to stop and pay attention.
No, Daniel squinted, and he looked down so he wouldn't have to meet Jack's eye. Actually, no, they didn't.
Well, my apologies for being so cautious, Dr. Jackson, Bill said. You can understand why I was nervous, though. I get a call from a man who supposedly died 6 years ago.
Funny thing, that, Wesley interrupted, still in the throes of his hero worship. When the greatly exaggerated rumors of your death got out, people said it was because you helped rediscover KV-5. You must know the story that Howard Carter didn't reseal the opening in 1903, not because he was unaware of the importance of the tomb, but because he was afraid of Ramsay's curse. So your disappearance proved he was right. And, oh dear, I am sorry. This is in dreadful taste, isn't it? You must forgive me. He turned to Jack. I'm afraid I didn't get your name.
Jack O'Neill. Daniel looked up at the tone of Jack's voice.
Ah, well, hello, Wesley said cautiously. Are you a linguist as well?
I'm Dr. Jackson's bodyguard.
Oh, Daniel said in utter amazement.
I see. Wesley eased a step backwards to demonstrate that he wasn't infringing on Daniel's personal space. A not unwise precaution, given everything that's been going on.
Everything that's been going on? Jack said.
And that would be what, exactly?
Wesley and Bill exchanged a glance.
You do know you're not the first person to ask about the Ishikido manuscript, Bill said.
Someone who claimed they were from the government also wanted to see it, Jack said.
I gather that.
How long ago was this? Did you show it to them?
They contacted Denver just a few days before he died. As far as I know, he allowed them to examine Randolph Carter's notebook, but not the actual manuscript. There have been two break-ins since then, and then last night...
Bill drew a shaking hand across his forehead.
I don't know what you folks saw, but I was in the back here reading when I felt this jolt.
Yes, that seems to be a characteristic of everyone who experienced something, Wesley agreed. I thought it was the beginnings of an earthquake, too.
I got up and ran under the doorframe and back here for shelter in case books started falling.
Bill got up to demonstrate.
You see, from here I can see all the way up to the front of the store. Then I heard a sound. I looked up and it was Denver at the front door. Big as life, tapping on the glass with the back of his knuckles,
like he used to do when he'd go out and forget his key. Oh, God.
Bill suddenly looked to Daniel much closer to 60 than 40, after all. He reached out to give the bookseller a hand as he lowered himself back into the chair.
There was someone with him, though. I think that's the only reason I didn't open the door. There was someone looking over his shoulder.
The creature we've all seen, Wesley said. Fat, white corpse fingers and no face.
Bill, can I get you something? How about a cup of tea?
I'll be fine.
He sat slumped in his chair. You don't last long in our business without getting used to far worse, eh?
Well, last night was no walk in the park, Wesley said with a tight smile.
How many people have you talked to about this? Daniel interrupted. He felt an odd tightness in his chest, as though he'd been running uphill for a long time. Just how many people do you think saw that apparition?
I've done some checking around this morning, and I've found half a dozen or so folks with similar stories. I don't know what the common denominator was. Maybe just that they were awake at 2 in the morning. Vampire, demon, human, it doesn't seem to have made much difference.
The vampires and demons saw it too, did they? Jack said, very seriously. Daniel could have kicked him.
Wesley became more guarded.
You believe you know something about this?
Is it related to the Ishikido manuscript?
I don't know. Maybe after I see it, I'll know more. Daniel spoke up fast before Jack could get a word in.
Time may well be of the essence, he added optimistically.
Bill and Wesley exchanged a long glance, and Wesley said at last,
It is Daniel Jackson, as though his name were a talisman.
Who else would we show it to?
You're right, Bill agreed. I wouldn't even know where to begin looking myself. And if there's a chance...
Yeah, it's for the best.
Very good. Dr. Jackson, I can take you to the manuscript, Wesley said briskly. I've been keeping it at my office ever since the first break-in here. Here's my card. He produced one from a small silver case, and with a glance at Jack first... Carefully broadcasting his inoffensive intentions, he handed it directly to Daniel.
It's not far from here, but if you're not familiar with the neighborhood, you can follow me over. My bike's right outside.
Thank you, Daniel said, feeling a little giddy. Since last night, everything had been getting bigger and bigger, revelations tumbling into revelations. And the possibility of finally learning something concrete about the Goa'uld's former hosts after so many months seemed to make every risk worthwhile. It was all connected, messily, irrationally, and only in his own mind, he knew, with Jack's touch and Jack's kisses. And he felt a sharp, sweet pang of arousal. As though it would be the most natural thing in the world to push Jack back onto Bill's neatly made-up camp bed right now and kiss him until their lips were bruised. And evidently, Daniel thought mildly, he was losing his mind.
Thank you, yes, he said to Wesley. Can we go right now?
Oh, Dr. Jackson, Jack interrupted. May I have a word with you outside first?
Jack?
We'll just be a minute, Jack explained politely, and since he looked entirely prepared to create a scene if necessary, Daniel repeated, Just a minute, I apologize, and followed Jack through the shop and out the front door.
As soon as it swung shut, the little bell tinkling behind them, he said, "Jack, in case you haven't noticed, those two are a little on the paranoid side, and if you..."
"You've got groupies," Jack said. "How come you never told me you had groupies?"
"This Wyndham Price person isn't a groupie. He's just..."
"All right, it's true. One of the reasons I had trouble getting people to take my conclusions seriously, despite a bedrock-solid archaeological record behind any theory I ever advanced."
"Daniel," Jack said, suddenly gentle,
"I know you were right. You don't have to convince me."
He loved this man, Daniel thought, and didn't know if he should be despairing or shouting it from the rooftops. Jesus, he loved him so much it hurt. A lot of the stuff I was saying really wasn't so different from things secret history conspiracy theorists had been saying for decades, that occultists and alchemists had been writing about in the West for 500 years, that Eastern writers had been saying for the past 4 or 5 millennia. It makes sense, of course. If memories of the Revenuers can be found in our earliest literature, it stands to reason the go-old occupation of Earth, which took place so much more recently, would have left its impression as well.
"And what does this have to do with the groupies?"
"When I started publishing about the age of the Great Pyramids, it caught the attention of some pseudo-archaeologists. Occultists like Wyndham Price. Apparently, I made an impression."
"Can you think of any reason why we should trust either of those two nutballs?"
Daniel blinked, wondering what in the world Jack was getting at.
"Why shouldn't we? They're going to show us the manuscript."
"Daniel, as soon as we arrived this morning, a complete stranger wandered in and offered to lead us God only knows where."
"It's right off Highland, actually," Daniel said, looking at the business card.
"My point is, it's a classic ambush tactic."
"Good thing I've got a bodyguard along, then."
"Geez, what in the world were you?"
"Daniel, they believe in vampires and demons and God only knows what else."
"Yes," Daniel said with exaggerated patience. "More or less exactly the sort of people you might expect to have a collection of rare occult texts." The little doorbell rang again, and Wesley poked his head out, smiling and hopeful.
"Well then, are we ready to go?"
Quote, "Methought a being more than vast, in size beyond all bounds, called out my name and saith, 'What wouldst thou hear and see? And what hast thou in mind to learn and know?'" End quote. The Corpus Hermeticum 1, 1906, G.R.S. Mead Translation. The hair was shorter, the shoulders broader. He knew how to clean and fire an M9, and his aim wasn't any worse than half the airmen on the base. What's more, if someone tried to shove him ass down in the sand, Jack hoped odds were at least even these days, that Daniel might actually shove back. One thing hadn't changed, though. All these years later, he was still full of shit.
"What do you mean you can't read it?"
Wesley had been startled by Jack's tone of voice. But Daniel didn't even look up.
"I mean, I can't read it. This is archaic Sumerian. What did you expect?"
Jack had to bite down on his first response, since Wesley was still in the room with them.
Actually, Daniel, I expected you would be, I don't know, able to read it. It's archaic Sumerian, Daniel repeated patiently. No one can read it. We can make more or less intelligent guesses, but the language itself is very poorly understood. The problem is that there's just so little extant material, Wesley put in helpfully. Jack glared at him. Wesley smiled back nervously, but held his ground. What complicates the situation is the fact that what texts do exist are almost entirely business records or school copy exercises. It's a shame that the Ishikido manuscript can't be made more widely accessible to Sumerian scholars, since it seems to be one of the longest complete narratives in the language. But obviously it's just too dangerous. Because it's magic, Jack said. Daniel glanced up, his eyes full of warning, but Jack was feeling cranky. Dangerous, powerful magic, despite the fact that no one can actually read it. I can hardly believe you're unaware of this manuscript's potential importance. Abdul al-Hazred may have had access to this while he was composing the Al-Azif itself. And the sequence of logograms that appear in the Ishikido manuscript are fundamental to works as diverse as the Corpus Hermetica and Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. Wesley was all but waving his arms around in his excitement, but Daniel had once more bent low over this holy grail, protected in a collector's case of non-reflective glass. He's right, Jack. He said, not argumentatively, simply enthralled. Even untranslatable, even unknown for most of Western history, I think this may have been an incredibly influential piece of writing. Jack took a deep breath. Look, he finally told Wesley. Can you give us just a minute here? What? Oh. Of course. Right. I'll just be... He jerked his thumb over his shoulder and left the small library. Jack sank down into a chair next to Daniel. No more bullshitting, he said mildly. Can this thing really help us? Daniel pointed to a line of cuneiform near the bottom of the first column. The smooth green alabaster was dull under incandescent lights, and Jack had an irrational desire to see it in the sunlight. Look at these signs, Jack. Ud, Ab, E, U. This is the same sequence I would pin to my chest whenever I went to sleep all those months when I was... trying to figure out how to deal with the effects of the light. I found them in an early 15th century alchemical text, back before I'd even heard of the Ishikido manuscript. And Jack, they worked. Ask Jim Ellison if you don't believe me. He could feel the weight of them. So you can read little pieces of it then. What does this bit mean? Screaming in protest, the demon departs by the window. Jack raised his eyebrows. Okay, and the demon is what? A gold? A revenuer? Is window kinda symbolic here? It could also mean bread grown in the light nourishes us in the darkness. Jack thought he already saw where this was going, but said gamely, all the same, little more obscure there. Or the chicken sleeps in the storm. Or even water flows from its niche, probably underground watercourse of some kind. Say,
water flows from a well to fuck the land.
Okay, stop. Just stop.
The bottom line is, you really can't read this.
So what good does it do us?
Daniel crossed his arms over his chest. No, I can't read it yet. But I've had more experience with various offshoots of archaic Sumerian over the past 4 years than anyone else alive on Earth. And as it turns out, Jack, I'm pretty good with languages. So if you'll give me some time, it's quite possible that I may be able to figure out enough of this to give you some answers.
How much time are we talking about here? Hours? Days? Weeks?
I don't know. Jack looked at him. Daniel looked right back, not budging an inch. And Jack was visited with the unwanted, unwelcome memory of stolen kisses against the hotel room door. Daniel's mouth opened under his own. Soft, warm lips that soon became so slick and so wet as they slid against Jack's.
Christ!
He wiped his hand over his mouth as though that could wipe away the memory as well, at least for the moment.
When he decided to screw something up, he went straight for the big time, didn't he?
I'm going to call Carter and tell her what's going on, which right now would be basically nothing. If they're not having any more luck than we are, there's no reason for them to stay in Cascade any longer.
Mm-hmm,
Daniel said, already hauling out his laptop, and obviously a million miles away. Jack left him there, walking out into the lobby of the old hotel Wesley claimed was his office. He thought being here in this building was another reason he felt so impatient and frustrated with Daniel. The damn place gave him the heebie-jeebies for some reason. Correction. He knew exactly why this place got under his skin. Since their arrival, he hadn't been able to shake a creepy suspicion that he already knew what the upper floors looked like. And since he'd never been here before in his life, the idea was patently ridiculous. And ridiculous things tended to make him cranky. Does Dr. Jackson need anything? Wesley pounced from his office behind the reception desk. I'm no linguist, of course, but I do have some reference materials that might be of use to him. Daniel's one-man fan club here was starting to get on his nerves as well.
I'm sure if Dr. Jackson needs anything, we'll be the first to know. Look, I need to make a phone call. Is there some place where I won't be interrupted?
Oh, of course. There's a private courtyard right through here. He led Jack through the lobby when a voice called from the landing.
Wesley, you around? I've just had a call from Kate. She's been talking to one of her friends on the force.
Right here, but Angel... The man coming down the stairs talked on, heading for the coffee maker with a single-minded determination that reminded Jack a little of Daniel. And that mess I walked into the other night, where that seamstress attacked her own baby. Turns out that wasn't an isolated incident at all. Just the only one the media happened to get a hold of. Yesterday afternoon, an au pair in Brentwood managed to stop her employer before she could start deboning her baby with a $300 hollow ground edge Santoku knife. And just last night at a neighborhood block party in Diamond Bar, a woman and her husband actually tried to lay their kid on the barbecue grill. That one'll probably make the evening news if it's not in this morning's paper.
How long has this coffee been sitting on the burner anyway?
He finally turned around, holding out the coffee cup, and saw that he had an audience.
Hello, he said, hardly missing a beat, and set the coffee down on the counter, just a little too close to the edge. He shoved it back before it could fall. I didn't realize we had guests. He looked at Wes, who spread his hands apologetically. Jack O'Neill, this is Angel.
As in Angel Investigations, Jack said.
Right. Angel smiled a little, looking faintly embarrassed.
We thought it was kind of catchy.
Jack felt his hackles rising at that smile. Self-deprecation was a learned trait for this man. He had absolutely no doubt. The hunched shoulders, the slight clumsiness with the coffee cup, all an act to make himself look harmless. After all, Jack thought, he should know. He'd done the same thing himself, often enough.